Can we continue?
Chair,
are we ready?
Yeah, we are ready, Chair. Before we deal with the questions, I just thought there's just one item that was not in our pack that I think we should just talk about. It is the transfer of the National Zoological Gardens to SANBI. We are at the beginning of that process, but I think it's important to just highlight it, and then we'll deal with it thoroughly when we come to our next, at our next report.
Yeah.
So I'll let the CEO just talk a little bit, just really highlight the top level issue.
Chair, thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair. Can I talk?
Yeah.
So you asked, actually, your committee asked, I think not the last meeting when we were visiting us at Kirstenbosch, one of your members actually raised the question, and at the time the decision hadn't been made, but now, just to inform you, the decision has been made, and the ministers, Minister Pando and Minister Molewa, have exchanged letters agreeing on the transfer, and the letters were exchanged just before the end of the financial year, 31st of March, and so we have worked out a transitional agreement with DST, Science and Technology, and NRF, because the zoo was under NRF, and the Department of Environment Affairs and SANBI, and we've got a four-way agreement in the transitional time. And the reason why we needed to have a transition is because part of the Labor Relations Act process had not yet been completed in the transfer. It's been an agreement, a governmental agreement, and the actual transfer will happen on October the 1st, when the LRA part of the discussion with the staff and the union is complete, and the staff then comes over to SANBI as well. So it's quite a big change. And again, Chair, we will come back to looking at altering our APP, but we can only really do it at the half term when the formal transfer happens. It's about 300 staff. As you know, some of them are scientists, so they fit perfectly within our Ready Science KPIs. But of course, the new area is the animal management, and then it's in two places. It's in Tshwane itself, at the National Zoological Garden space, and then it also has a land portion in Makopane, which is like a farm that actually breeds animals and also provides food stock for the animal management activity.
Okay.
So it's
in
a big expansion.
In Limpopo,
yeah.
Okay.
Owned though by national, it'll be a nationally owned public works piece of land. So that's also quite an interesting moment. But in terms of the KPI, it will be probably just something around the animal management, because they also manage visitors, and they also get income through the gate, and they also do tourism and enjoyment and education in their facility.
Well, you've got Sand Parks, so maybe Sand Parks might be interested in helping you to deal with that part. Okay, so we are going to ask to take hands. We don't anticipate that we'll take more than 10 minutes with you from our very brief lunch discussion there. But yeah, let's get the hands. Honorable Peden.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just say to Tanya, it was a very professional presentation and no doubting your passion for SANBI, but I would just like to say in future I think you should refrain from incorporating political jargon into your reports. First question.
Political jargon, better. Example, I didn't hear that.
Radical economic transformation.
Okay, all right. Okay.
First question, the invasive species, coming into the core business of SANBI. Obviously, we know the importance of combating that. But I just want to know whether the SANBI employs entomologists, because I know of work being done at Rhodes University where there's been biological control, certainly of weeds like water hyacinth and that. And, you know, you spoke of the science regarding invasive species. So I just want to know whether you've got entomologists and people working on biological control, those two things. Then on page 1428, slide 28, the advice to support national and international policy processes, the requests from the DEA and provinces, municipalities. I just want to know whether SANBI actually gets involved in specific EIA applications. Yes or no? And then the last one is just an observation that I think 52% employee the funding is high. But that's a comment, and it should be addressed in the future. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My comment is the worms that were seen in Northwest Province earlier this year. What was the name of those worms, and how did they affect SANBI or local farmers? My question, I've got two questions. Do you have cases of poaching of some of your specimens in your botanical gardens? If yes, which are the botanical gardens affected and the species? My second question is, why haven't you included reduction of death of your specimen as a performance target? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. you are not here when you're taking hands. So you still want to ask a question? Honorable Mokoye. All right, that's fine. Okay, thanks. We're targeting 10 minutes engagement with SANBI.
Okay. Yes. And just to appreciate the report, I think, CEO, you've been there for a long time, so you report, you give two, three reports at once, one written and the other elaboration and so on and so on. So, by the way, at some point you had said that you will be leaving SANBI, isn't it? When is that? Perhaps you'll clarify that, whether it has been extended or you're still there or whatever. Chair, the first that I wanted to understand, and I won't refer to slides, but there's a slide where you talked issues of climate change. Just to understand whether have you established the impact of climate change on biodiversity as yet, where you are, not necessarily broadly in the country. The second is some of these gardens are in the provincial sphere jurisdiction. But then my interest is whether your collaboration with them, I know you said you're reading from the same page and so on, a lot of things. But my interest is whether they are being maintained almost on similar standards with the national ones across the country. Just to have that understanding and all that. The third is the 3% increase or target on visitor numbers, as you acknowledged as well, I think is very low. Taking into consideration, if I were to put my point clearer, taking into consideration that yearly there's population growth, that's one. But second, that even the growth of the middle class, particularly African or black middle class, has been there owing to the government social transformation programs and so on, so that the potential exists. It's not about there being no people to can be able to visit your area. So we can actually increase that. I'm saying that there's a case why I'm actually serious on this particular point. The last, because the very last will just be a comment. The last is, you used to talk about your scientists identifying or discovering new plant species and so on, and you had a target for that. This time around, I missed that. Whether you're tired of identifying new species or they just don't exist. But lastly, Chair, you have to appreciate the number of publications that you said are even peer-reviewed from 80 to 85. It's encouraging. Very, it's some inspiration. I think if you keep on doing that and even improving on the numbers, that takes us elsewhere. So I wanted to end by that comment. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Basically, those are the questions. I just on the expenditure one. I think we should request that you look at that and see if we can contain that. 52. I think there might be still room for looking at that over the medium term period, so that it's below 50%. Like we asked also SANParks yesterday to do that. So I think we must also ask SANB to look at that as well. But yeah, basically, I don't have much from my side. If you can quickly respond to the questions, so we can wrap up.
Members. Honorable Pedan, is that how you pronounce your name? Pedan. Oh, Pedan. Okay. So it's funny to hear the word entomologist because I'm actually an entomologist originally. I didn't know anybody knew the word. So the issue about invasive species, it's really been an amazing journey to get to move from being from it being a project of the department which we ran to it moving into our core business, because as you probably know, invasive species becoming the biggest threat to biodiversity in the world, really. And of course it's linked with climate change, because as it gets wetter and warmer in some parts and drier and warmer in others, on top of the fact that there's the highest CO2 level globally since the dinosaurs, globally, that opportunistic species, plant species and animal species begin to jump out of their normal population area. And that's really what invasive species is about. And it includes pests and includes things like hyacinth and, you know, pests in gardens, including the armyworm. So what we're seeing is one of the highest threats to biodiversity is what the impact of climate change is having on species. So we, our main role in invasive species now, which I think is very much in our mandate, is to provide the science and evidence-based information for better and more efficient control. And the Department of Environmental Affairs still continues through their NRM department to be the major driver of the actual control. So, but sometimes you need to do some control in order to understand the science. So, for example, we will continue to be involved with the emerging species work so that we can get the information in order to give good science. So it's a growing area. And again, like every other institution, the strain really is having the capacity, the human capacity, to do certain things. And so the best way to do things in South Africa is to harness the capacity of other institutions. And that has been, I think, one of our most amazing strengths. We have a managed network, we call it, a network, not just a network, but an actual network where we have MOUs and MOAs and joint funding agreements, etc., to provide the information and data. So, for example, Rhodes University definitely is part of our managed network. In fact, all the universities involved with any research have become part of our network. We have a relationship with them. Often the scientists sit in their labs, not in our labs. And our job is to harness that capacity, set the agenda sometimes, raise the money sometimes, create research projects that's useful for the nation, for the national level. So it's been an interesting journey for the institution. I mean, Honorable Makwela is right. I've been here 10 years now, and it's been a very interesting journey to understand where you can get maximum benefit from that partnership, rather than building the capacity in competition with other institutions like University of Cape Town or Rhodes or Fort Hare or Venda University. So we have got those kind of relationships with all those universities in order to deliver our mandate. So the issue about getting involved in specific EIAs, we don't. We do not get involved in specific EIAs, but we are... we've got a vested interest in making those environmental impact assessments be more efficient and more effective. So our information that we develop about the environment, about ecosystems, about species, about the maps that we produce, for example, is for public consumption. It is for the public good. Any individual can go in there and find information, as much as there is commonly known information about an area, right to cadastral level. In other words, the plot of land that you own, in a way. So you can find out right down to cadastral level in our system whether there's a threatened species, what is the topography, what's the water issue, what is the ecosystem threat status of that area. And in that way, that's how we support the environmental impact assessment community to have better and more veracible information about the area that they're doing. Where we have been engaged more tightly, though, has been working with the Department of Environmental Affairs. Department of Environmental Affairs asked us, as one of their entities, to engage with the development of the C, the Strategic Environmental Assessment instrument that they're developing for the SIPs, for the strategic infrastructure projects. And we particularly have been providing information into, and it's three institutions, it's a Geoscience Council, it's the CSIR who leads it, and then there's SANBI. And we are providing the biodiversity and topography and ecosystem information into developing the strategic environmental assessment thing. I think some of you came with us as to the Karoo when we were doing some work to develop our ability to provide good information around the Karoo. So in as far as do we get involved in specific EIAs, no. In as far as developing better knowledge and information systems, yes.
Summarize.
Okay, sorry, am I going
we
on
know
too long?
You can speak.
Sorry.
Yeah, just summarize.
Chair, I must say I disagree about the 52% spent on employees, and I think quite a few of you have raised that issue. I don't know what my colleagues in SANParks have, but we have an organization that is knowledge-based, and some of those skills, knowledge skills, are rare, and there's lots of competition for those knowledge skills, and we have actually come down in percentage on our employee costs over time. I remember at one point it was something like, Mukhetsi, I don't know if you remember, something like 76-80%, and we've come right down to 52%. We also have quite a lot of labor-intensive work that we run 12 areas or 11 gardens in 12 places in the country, and so there's quite a lot of labor intensivity in that space. So I'm sure this will be an ongoing thing, but maybe we can give you a history of our employment costs. Honorable Kekana,
maybe on that, maybe we must do that.
Yeah, give
if
you a little analysis.
Very strong that those figures are acceptable, then maybe it's important that we come and make a case for it.
Yeah,
and give us the history and justify why those numbers must be like that.
Okay.
I think let's agree on that approach. If you feel very strong that the numbers must be like that, I think you must come and let's have a conversation around that issue.
That's a good idea. Yes, Chair, all we'll right. do that, Honorable Chair. So Honorable Kekana asked about why we don't make as a key performance indicator the death of specimens and species, and I guess it's because it's not totally in our control as an institution, so best to make or key performance indicator something that you can actually control. But it is death of biodiversity loss is a threat, but not completely totally in Sandby's control, and that's why it's not there. The armyworm is an invasive species. It is an amazing invasive species. It's reached some parts of South Africa now, but it's definitely ravaging Zambia and Zimbabwe and Malawi. And we're watching it. We're working together with ARC, the Agricultural Research Council, on it. And there's already a disaster response mechanism led by the ARC, and we're supporting them on it. But definitely we're working on that. Yes, we do have some poaching of plants in our garden, particularly in cycads. We do have some cycad poaching. There was a cycad poaching incident in Kirstenbosch around Christmas time. We've had to just increase our security in that. Cycads are highly valuable instruments. Impact on climate change. So all our gardens are within the national sphere. They might be based in the province, but they're in the national sphere. Some of the provincial gardens and open spaces in towns, we have a relationship with them, and we try to develop standards with them, and we have joint projects with them, some EPWP projects we have with provincial-run gardens, mainly, not so much provincial-run gardens, but mainly municipal-run gardens. But I think it's a... interesting question, and maybe we'll come back to you with a more detailed answer on that.
Apparently, she talks about the theft of specimen. Apparently, the question was the reduction of theft of specimen from the gardens.
The loss of specimen from theft.
Theft.
Yes.
Stealing. Yes.
Yeah,
is
the cycads. We've had a few incidents of theft
in
the middle of the night
of
people coming to steal our cycads in Kirstenbosch. I think that's what you're talking about.
That was a question. About
and we've just had to increase our security on that. Yeah. I think that. The question that Honorable Makuvela asked about our role in improving other spheres of government's gardens is something maybe we can come and give a specific report on going for future, but it's very important. And then I just want to say I agree with you that 3% is too low. I indicated that we are a little bit risk-averse there, and yet we have consistently performed higher and have had to adjust our key performance indicator up every year. So I was just asking the CFO now, why is it, and it's really about being risk averse in that space and wanting to think. Yeah. I think that's
okay.
All. I think those are all the questions.
All right. Chair?
Thank you, Chair. I thought I should deal with the issue that you raised about the CEO leaving us a couple of months. So to speak. It's a very sad loss for us as SANBI, and lost to government, because you've already mentioned how passionate and professional Tanya is, and she's been running this organization in a very, very, very professional way. She makes my job easy as chair. I never have to get into intervening in management issues because they're so good. All I can say is we are a victim of our own act. You know, our act is written in such a way that the CEO's term of office is 5 years, renewable only once. And I think it's something we have to think about. Your predecessor was on board how long?
16 years.
16 years. So now here you are. The way the act is written, it's tying our hands. We're losing her, and we don't want to lose her. She's happy to be here, but the act says, you know, she can only be here for 2 terms. So maybe it's something we should think about. You'd rather leave it open, and when you're not happy, let the person go. But to lose somebody when you are happy with them only because the act says it's just 2 terms. So that's what's facing us as SANB. So we had to, as a board, you know, talk about and look at succession, and we had to communicate that to the minister, and then, of course, eventually to the board, because we needed to open the position up for advertising. So we are at an advanced stage of where we are with the process. First of all, for us it was clear that we need to have her successor must be somebody who's a good leader, a manager, but more importantly also to also be a scientist. So it's quite a rigorous process that we went through. We are almost at the end. They're hearing this for the first time because we have kept it very, 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 very tight, you know, because we didn't want to create any talks about it. So we're at an advanced stage. The board has made a decision about the candidate that we have recommended. So I'm now in the process of talking to the minister about how far we are. So the CEO will be with us until the end of
August.
And as I say, it's something we really, really have to seriously think about. She's still young. She can do the job, but, you
not
know.
So young.
And you're young.
Yeah. Well,
but that's
what you're saying. She's not young at all.
No. She's kidding. She is.
Okay. That's that. So thank you very much. At least this time, I think we're happy with the presentation, with the report, with everything about SANB. We can pick up. There are no issues of what you have presented. We visited the park, the garden, not the park. We call it the garden. We were there, and I think it helped to understand even some of the plans that you are telling us about, because at least we're there physically. We could see for ourselves what is happening around the garden. So we've got a better understanding of the issues at that site. So thank you very much. We will then invite the Oceans and Coast to come and give us a presentation on the bill. So the last working day is what, end of August? Okay. You will still have appeared before the committees a couple of times before you go. One more time. Yeah. I think we must, before you leave, we must prepare something so that we can come and talk about the salary issue. Have a conversation. It's going to be better to discuss it when you are here than when you... Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Welcome. Welcome, DDG, and your team. The DG has apologized. She did say before she left that you are with team of legal eagles. So so we are in capable hands. So yeah, it's over to you.
Thank you, Chair. It is with excitement that today we will present to you the first piece of legislation following the Ocean Pagisa process that started in 2014. And there are two branches that are involved in the effort today. It is ourselves, Oceans and Coast, and I have Mr. Popos to my right, who is the leader on marine spatial planning. And to my right, I have Advocate Razak, who will do the presentation, who comes from DDG Abadaz division. And we've got Advocate Nikki de Kock sitting there at the back, who also is part of the legal team. And Chair, the presentation will be led by Advocate Razak. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, we'll go to the first slide, if that's okay. I'm going to try and be concise because I understand that we have time constraints. That first picture... Thank you, Chair. You'll see the we've started off with a picture, which is actually just to give you a snapshot view of why we need marine spatial planning. You'll see to the left, there's very few vessels, old-time vessels, and to the right is a very busy ocean space, and it really illustrates the situation that we're facing today. Before this, we had some transport. We had a few cruise ships. We had some tankers and that kind of thing operating in the ocean space that's our EEZ and beyond. And these days, there's a lot more activity. You've got oil rigs, you've got transportation, you've got pollution, you've got tourism, you've got ecotourism. So you'll see that it's a lot more busy and there's a lot more activity, which means that we now need to manage it a lot more carefully than we used to. If we go to the next slide, it talks to what is marine spatial planning. It's a very new concept in terms of legislation because the rest of the world also hasn't got developed legislation. We're one of the first countries, one of the few first countries to actually develop legislation in this area. It's a governance process of managing the space in the sea, the times at which they travel and how they interact with each other and what kind of activities are happening and how to make sure that those activities don't clash with each other and to achieve in this way economic, social, and ecological objectives. So we're looking at protection, conservation. We're also looking at benefit. The shared vision of marine spatial planning, it's got these nice words here. It's a productive, healthy, and safe ocean that's accessible, understood, equitably governed, and sustainably developed and managed for the benefit of all. That's kind of your mission statement for marine spatial planning. The benefits of marine spatial planning is to unlock the economy in the ocean because our terrestrial resources are becoming more and more strained, and we're also looking to opportunities in the ocean. And we're aware that there's a lot of things in the sea, under the sea, in the ground, beneath the sea, that can yield benefits. But we also need to do this in a sustainable way so that we don't destroy the ocean and its environment at the expense of gaining short-term economic gain. So we're looking at trying to balance these factors appropriately, enhancing the achievement of social benefits, strengthening society's interaction and understanding of the ocean, promoting a healthy environment and sustainable use of the marine resources, which include fish, which has long been a resource that we've been tapping into, also oil and gas and whatever other potentials there are, and to contribute to good ocean governance in doing this. And the way that we want to do this through the bill and through the instruments available to us is through ordered and systematic planning prioritization so that we know what we're dealing with and we do this in a way where we have greater understanding. The purpose of the MSP bill, in the context of all of these things that I've said, is really to give the legal status to this kind of planning across government. It's the first time we've got something that's, that we've got a piece of legislation that's pioneering integrated and coordinated planning in such a huge space, which is it's actually larger than our territorial coverage and what we manage. So there's a lot of potential out there, but there's also a lot of potential for conflict, and there's also a lot of competing interests and activities, and it's up to us as government to ensure that when we're managing the space, we do it in the most responsible and coordinated way. So we create an environment to ensure this decision-making and move away from sector and silo planning, because before, transport would be doing its own thing. Mining would be doing its own thing, environment would be doing its own thing, and then when we want to declare marine protected areas, all of a sudden there's resistance from everybody because they say no, they have mining interests in an area allocated by us. Now it's that kind of silo planning that we want to move away from, so that we all get around the table and all the different sectors and government interests then get to talk about what are priorities, which are the most important ones, and how do we make everybody win at the end of the day. So through the proper planning, unlocking the economic potential in the ocean space, and very importantly, to ensure environmental conservation, because environmental conservation is the overlay that informs whether an activity is sustainable or not. The background to this, you've heard from Dr. Maikiso, Operation Pakisa in August 2014 gave us timeframes, and MS Marine Spatial Planning and the bill were identified as key initiatives that must come out of there. And this is now the fruition of one of those initiatives, which is the bill. After Operation Pakisa, there was a national working group on MSP that was established with multiple departments representatives. It's a very much a learning-as-we-go process. And we're not arrogant to believe that we have the answers to everything, but we certainly are starting somewhere, and we want to be able to, going forward, implement in a practical way that's going to be beneficial to everybody, and to try and do this in a mature and coordinated fashion. The draft bill was published on the 24th of March 2016, comments closed on 23rd of May 2016, and then Cabinet did the final approval, because then we reviewed, we took into account the comments, and we went through the process again, and Cabinet approved the bill for introduction on the 1st of March 2017. The next slide just deals with the stakeholder consultations that we've had through the process, which started, of course, a couple of years ago. The next slide, we've got the responsibility for marine spatial planning, and we've got a list of the departments. There are a couple of additional departments that will be added to the suite, and you'll see that in the bill. It's going to be, we've got the Department of Science and Technology as a player, telecommunications, and then we've got mineral resources. So there were some of these other departments that also said, listen, we also need to be part of this because we do have a stake in the telecommunications, because they lay cables under the sea. The responsibilities of the National Working Group on Marine Spatial Planning is really, they are the technical working group. They do all the technical work for the planning. So all the information, and we'll do a quick synopsis of the bill to give you an idea of how this works. This is just an overview. What happens is that the technical working group gets all the information, and all the sectors are represented, and they get experts on marine spatial planning. They get whatever other experts they need, including legal, including policy experts, and technical science, scientific expertise that's required. A whole lot of deliberation happens at that level, and then they produce either the marine spatial planning framework, which we'll deal with a bit later, and also they will then develop these marine area plans, which form the basis of marine spatial planning. The next slide just gives you an overview of how this works. It's not necessarily in this order, but it's also just asking the committee to bear in mind that this process has already begun. And it can continue without a bill, but the bill gives it additional legal status so that there's continuity if there's a change in government, for example. And then they know that this is something that's written into the law and it can't be avoided. So a lot of this, the knowledge and information base, which is the first key there, you'll see that is already a work in progress. There's a program that's already being established. And into this program, into this knowledge base, because without the knowledge and the information, you can't plan. You don't know what there is in the sectors. You don't know what they're wanting to do. You don't know what the scientific information is. You don't know what the stakeholders are saying. So we need all that information, the sector information, that's going to inform how we prioritize. And they've got to build a case, the case economically, socially, and insofar as ecosystem management is concerned. And all that data gets placed in that information. There's also the Marine Spatial Framework, which is already underway, and it develops the broader objectives and principles, and a lot of it gives flesh to what's in the bill in a way that it explains the whole process in a way that legislation can't. And it gives you the big approaches to marine spatial planning. And then the final component of this in the process flow is the development of what are called marine area plans. Now, we would have liked to call this a marine spatial plan, but it's very difficult to have one huge plan because you're dealing with an amorphous area. It's not a surface area. It's an ocean that and our coastline is alone over 3,000 kilometers. That's just the coastline. Now, when you're talking about 200 nautical miles out into the sea, you're talking about a larger mass than our land mass. So in order for us to be able to plan properly, we need a lot of information and input into mapping that entire area. So in order for us to do this in a manageable way, the more practical approach would be to do marine area plans and delineate specific areas and maps with all the data, with smaller planning units. And at the moment, we've got we're looking at West Coast, East Coast, Southeast Coast, and the Prince Edward Islands as units that we would like to tackle and going forward. And you'll see that even though they are big areas, because we're doing a learn-as-you-go approach, it's iterative. In other words, it's a cycle, so it continues. It's not something that you do and it stops. As you get more information, you update, you review. This is the planning process because it's the most practical way to approach it without becoming stagnant and irrelevant within a month or 2 months' time. So the way the institutional arrangements have been set out, we have the technical working group, which I explained to you earlier, that makes the recommendations to the DGMSP committee. DGMSP committee, and it's comprising of the same departments that you saw that's in the National Working Group. All of these departments are represented in each of these institutional groups. So the DGMSP committee then makes a recommendation. They can then decide they want to refer it back to the National Working Group if there's unanswered questions or if there's issues that they want specifically addressed. Or they can make a recommendation to the Minister's MSP committee with the same representatives from the same departments for a final decision. So you'll see it pretty much feeds into almost that cabinet system of managing this, but these are very targeted, specific committees. The other good thing about these committees is if any other department is affected or maybe directly or even indirectly, they can be co-opted whenever required. So it's not a static body. There's another question that's important to note, and that the interaction of the Marine Spatial Planning Bill with the other sector laws, because there seemed to have been a lot of confusion during the public comment process, and we've now cleared that up. Individual sector departments implement their own laws, but they implement their laws in line with the broad Marine Spatial Planning priorities. So, for example, if in the marine area plan, the spatial planning, they say this area is not for MPAs, we're prioritizing it as fishing grounds, or we're prioritizing it for exploration, for oil and gas exploration. there's other areas that have been prioritized, marine protected areas. We cannot then, as a sector department, declare an MPA in an area that has been identified in this joint process, because we would have been part of that process for MPAs. And that's the kind of thing. Departments have to adhere to the planning, but the planning bill doesn't do any enforcement. It doesn't require any regulation or permitting. That all happens in the sector laws. So the Marine Living Resources Act will continue. The DMR, the Mineral Resources Act, will also continue on its own enforcement. But departments then buy in this planning process to committing to adhering to the integrated principles and decisions made at this level. And, of course, it's enforced at political level. This is just for planning and coordination. The next thing, just to let you know on the status of the bill, this was, when it was done, it was being tabled, but it's already being tabled in Parliament. It's for introduction. It's been certified by the state law advisors. It's tagged as a Section 76 bill. Just to advise you, with regard to the Marine Spatial Planning Framework, which was being developed in a parallel process, and the one was informing the other, this is due to be gazetted within a couple of days. So its publication is imminent. And it will give actually more, it will be an advantage because it gives more explanation to the context of the bill, which otherwise is not readily available without a supporting document. That's it on my presentation. We were also asked to go very quickly through a clause-by-clause description in the bill. It's a very short bill. Chairperson, if you're inclined, I can continue to that. Thank you. I'm going to go past the preliminary sections and the definitions and all of that. We can when we do a more all the stuff that we've covered, I'm going to just highlight you in the bill where we're dealing with it. The first key aspect that's important here is when you look at the objects of the Act, and you'll see what's reflected there is what I was dealing with in the presentation. It may be in slightly different words. It's about what we're planning to do here. Develop the planning system, managing the changing environment for all sectors, promoting sustainable economic opportunities, integrated planning, good ocean governance. And then, of course, the documentation and the mapping and the knowledge management, and also, importantly, to give effect to South Africa's international obligations. The application of the Act is, it really applies to marine spatial planning and in South African waters, and that's particularly defined. It includes our EEZ and any extension of the continental shelf if we should be successful in that. And importantly, it also binds all organs of state, because if we don't write this in sometimes in legislation, it's a standard clause, you'll see, it can be interpreted to exclude government. The conflicts with legislation, it's a standard provision, it just talks to no other bill or no other piece of legislation on marine spatial planning, not sector legislation, not fisheries, not mining, not transport, planning. That this bill will take precedence over any other legislation that purports to deal with marine spatial planning, because, of course, you don't want to deal with conflicts and duplication. The principles and criteria for marine spatial planning, these have been very carefully developed with the MSP group. They've been going for training. The National Working Group has increasingly been familiarizing themselves with all the aspects relating to marine spatial planning, and these principles were developed in that context. Most of them it's dealing with sustainability, management of resources, identification of economic opportunities, because of course that's one of the key things that we need to bear in mind. Promotion of ecosystems and earth system approach to ocean management, which focuses on maintaining ecosystem structure and functioning within a marine area. This is a very key principle from Department of Environmental Affairs particularly, because if we take the holistic ecosystem management approach, we stand a better chance of protecting and allowing sustainable growth rather than to say, well, look, you can't do this because we want to preserve, or you can do this, but you need these and these and these limitations. We want to take an overall holistic perspective and look at the environment as a whole. Then there's adaptive management, because we can't be static in this, a precautionary approach, which is a standard principle for environmental management. And then, of course, best available scientific information is critical. Equitable resolution of conflicts and disputes, and of course efficiency. We want to minimize we must have decision making processes which minimize negative impacts financially, socially, economically. Basically, what we're saying is we're looking for win-win situations wherever possible. Principle of good administration and international obligations. You'll see that there is a specific clause saying that if there's a conflict between existing uses, the idea is to maximize coexistence where possible. So if you can have these activities happening in the same place at the same time or at different times in the same place, that would be ideal rather than cutting somebody completely out and replacing it with someone else. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to look at. And where it's not possible, you know, you look at at equity and what are the other foundational principles of marine spatial planning to guide. So these are important for the decision makers, and it holds decision makers accountable. The next clause, which is clause 6, deals with the different components of marine spatial planning system, and I've mentioned all of those in my presentation. The framework is the knowledge base, the plans. And then, of course, the implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of these plans and the review of these plans, which is an ongoing process. 7 deals specifically with the knowledge and information system, which then zones into all the kinds of things that must be submitted by the sectors in order for us to make proper decisions. And we've made that broad. We've put in specifics as well as made it as broad as possible. It's also a subject to the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And then the next clause, which is clause 8, deals with consultation. And we've put in who we think are the key consultative bodies, but also put an obligation that relevant stakeholders must be consulted, and that these processes, we're bound by the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act in any event. And if you look at the Marine Spatial Planning Framework when it comes out, you'll see that there's quite an intensive consultation that goes around that gives effect to clause 8. And clause 9 is about the National Working Group on Marine Spatial Planning. It's, as I explained to you, all those departments, and they've already been working steadfastly, in fact, since PAKISA. And they then draft the plan, the framework. They develop the marine area plans, and they use all of these things. They look at the synergies, compatible and incompatible uses, projections and forecasts, the analysis of emerging uses, new things that are emerging in the ocean, environmental change impacts, biological, chemical, and physical characteristics of the ocean, including species, habitats, and ecosystems. All of this needs to be fed into there, and you'll see there's a whole host of other information relating to the environment, relating to the activities, relating to benefits, economies, etc. That must then be fed into that will inform this planning process. They can appoint a panel of experts to advise them on any aspect of their functions in terms of this act, and it's important that we keep that as wide as possible, because this is a learn-as-you-go process. You may not know what you're going to need at a particular point in time, what kind of technical information you'll need, and the working group must have access to that information. And that information, and throughout the process, there's a consultation that occurs with it. When they're done, they then send it to the DG committee. I explained the DG committee is similar. It's got all the DGs from the relevant departments. They can appoint alternates. And then you've got all the workings of the committee are in there. It deals with your quorum. It deals with rules of procedure. Because there was initial draft, it was widely crafted so they could create their own rules, and there was a lot of objection from stakeholders and government alike, saying, listen, we need more certainty in this, and this is how we built the certainty into the process, and we've made provisions for the chairing, etc. It doesn't mean that they can't develop other rules as they go along, but these are the minimum that must be complied with. They can also co-opt as required, and they make recommendations on all of these aspect where there's something where there's a user conflict, for example, and one department's not happy, one sector's not happy, and the other, and another two are happy, or vice versa. They have to, the National Working Group is important. They do a comprehensive report, and that report will set out all their thinking, all the information, everything that they use to make the decision. That goes to the DG committee, and the DG committee can still say, listen, I'm not happy with this. Have you addressed X, Y, Z? And then once the DG committee is happy that they've got a well-thought-out decision, based on that report, it then goes to the ministerial committee for final approval. And at that stage, the ministerial committee may also resubmit if they're not happy with something or if they need more information. But ultimately, if they make that decision is then final. The next section, which is clause 12, the publication. It's important that if we have these plans and this is it's got legal status, we must be able to publish it, and of course we have to publish it in the Gazette. You'll see it's written a bit oddly because it's not like all the other things you must publish in the Gazette and finish. It says that there are those parts that can be published in the Gazette, and this is because the maps that get published for marine special planning are very complicated. They've got layers of different data superimposed upon each other, and it's not often easy to be able to print that in a Gazette, and they won't be able to make sense of it, and you can't do coordinates because it's not necessarily the coordinates on the boundaries, but it's about several layers of uses going right down to the bottom of the sea in the water column. So when you're dealing with those different types of uses going down and across, your maps become very complicated. So in order for us to make sure that there's certainty on that, those must be published on an appropriate, secure electronic platform that's available to anybody at any point in time so that you can reference at any particular given time what a marine spatial area plan was. That's why you'll find that clause a bit differently drafted. And then, of course, clause 13 is the regulation section. This is a critical section because there's a lot of stuff that, like if at the moment, because we're learning as we go along, we don't know exactly, many departments are not absolutely ready with a sector plan that has everything in it. But they're working with best available information at the moment, and this is how we're starting the process. Eventually, we want to evolve to a state where we know this is exactly what we want from this each department. And we must want to be able to make regulations saying, listen, this and this and this and this must be submitted. At this point, we may not be able to implement the bill if we put up front what we think needs to go in there. So we have to leave space for regulations for those kinds of nitty-gritty details and submission and where to lodge and how to lodge and that kind of thing into the knowledge and information system. Then the last, the second last clause is on the review of the plans. I mentioned that it's a cyclical iterative process. It repeats. It's ongoing. It is not static. But there is at least every 5 years there must be a review. But in between, there are amendments. If there's suddenly a major weather alert that we get from SOARS that may impact on something, one wants to be able to deal with that as it comes and not when it's too late. So there is that power to be able to deal with that. There's also, if we need to change, we must be able to do this. So you can do this as it's necessary. you can amend as necessary. But but there is an obligation at least every 5 years to do a major overhaul and see whether you're still on track or not. And then there's the short title and commencement, and that's all that we can say about the legal framework. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. That's the presentation. It does appear that the actual details of this is on a framework. It's in the framework. So the bill will just provide a sort of a legal framework, and the details of which will be in the framework, as I understand. But I thought you will sort of attach to this, give us some explanatory memorandum where you then explain in detail the bill and probably each clause as it is. I see you are nodding, so it's something I'm making sense. Okay. Colleagues, there's the presentation of the bill. You can just ask some questions, but as you know, that we are required by the Constitution to handle this bill in a particular way, so we'll have to follow that process. But for now, let's get preliminary views from honorable members, Honorable Peden, and then Honorable Edwards, Gekan, and Makubele.
Thanks, Chair. I'd just like to get clarity on the jurisdiction of South Africa, because we've got territorial waters, which I believe are 12 nautical miles, and then we're speaking of 200 nautical miles, which you mentioned in your report. So I'm a bit confused. Can a country make legislation for area outside of your nautical waters? I think I'd like that one to be answered. And then the area plans. So I'm a bit slow on this one. Have any plans been drawn up, or are they to be drawn up in the future?
Okay. Honorable Edward.
Okay, I'm going to sound stupid because... stop laughing, Econo. I'm not a legal person. I'm an arty person, so please bear with me. So basically, okay, understand what this bill proposes. Understand, like, it kind of wants to put it a little bit more in a box, a little bit more, okay... This is where you can go, this is where you can't go, etc. Okay. What are we currently, how are we currently operating? I just want to know how we're changing, like from where to where. And then I also want to ask, and I can't remember the name, so I'm going to explain myself, that we applied or we are busy applying to extend our border into the ocean. Does it make sense what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. How is that going to affect, the bill going to affect that application as well? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My question is based on Section 8 of the bill. Is there a common understanding of consultation throughout the government? Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Part of my challenge now is that when I look at it, Clause 3 says the application of the Act says that the Act applies to all organs of state, as if it does not affect other users. But in the process of its formulation and consultations, you did interact with NGOs and other people to make their inputs, probably. And I had thought we're going to be managing planning as well as managing how, particularly when it comes to conflict, it may not just be organs or various departments which have those. Probably when you talk relocations and so on and so on, you're not relocating organs of state. Probably you are relocating communities around those areas. Now, I take it applies to everybody. And my point really, Chair, is when it goes to page 4, where you're talking the principles and the issues of conflicts, which is item 2 and 5.1i, which talks how you resolve that. Knowing that we're still going to consult on our own and whatever, but I'm just not sure how this bill ultimately, as it becomes law, it will be equitable there. May mean that smaller players may be at the receiving end. That's the point I'm driving at, that the conflict may usually be to relocate those ones, and the big guys remain operating and so on and so on, if you get what I'm saying. If my question is not so pointed, I think you can still engage with it. But still on page 3, on, under the object of the Act, D talks that we're going, one of the provisions there is for the documentation, mapping and understanding and so on and so on. I thought documentation in the circles of government is obvious. It's as if we have been doing things without documenting them. So if we are still going to provide 2, under the objects of the Act, D, two subsection D in particular, says provide for the documentation, mapping and understanding of the physical, chemical, and so on and so on. So I'm just saying I thought that would be obvious. The last one, Chair, of course, one will still, now that we explained most of the things, still go through it. Under a Director General Committee 7B, in relation to the National Working Group, it says refer the Marine Area Plan and the accompanying report back to the National Working Group with specific instructions for consideration. An instruction you can consider. I thought an instruction tells you what to do. So it's as if here the Director General Committee is more powerful than the National Working Committee. It says this is what has to happen. If my understanding of English, it's not legal English, but just the the layman's English will say an instruction, Chair, may not be considered. You are told what to do. But perhaps that can be clarified differently. Thanks.
Okay. Who's coming first?
It's me, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you.
Introduce yourself again.
Yes, I was about to do that, Chair, because I learned from the last time I was here. My name is Kobani Popos from the Oceans and Coast Branch, Department of Environmental Affairs. But I would just like to thank the inputs from all the honorable members and the chairperson. I will take a few responses from the questions which were asked. And the first one is the, what are we moving for? I think it's from this honorable members to what? I think currently in South Africa, before we started this process, each and every sector department was planning on its own, irrespective of what the other department is doing. And then with that, we started seeing a situation where there are unintended consequences, for instance, between fisheries and mining, there could be issues which should be raised on certain specific fisheries grounds which are important for breeding, but possibly more important in terms of job creations, which is also a mining issue that the sector department could actually show statistics that we could do much more better. So to have these plans in place when we're discussing in Operation Pakisa was quite important, that we have a framework legislation and planning process, because we want to expand the economic contribution of the ocean sector in comparative to other countries with a similar ocean space and coastline. We have to start planning together, otherwise we're going to get to a stage where we will have sectors competing with each other, and we won't be able to resolve issues if we don't have a planning, a marine special planning system. And then the marine area plans, we have just finished the process of developing the marine special planning framework. That should be gazetted in the next few days, and the reason for that is that we did publish it for public comments last year. We received all the comments from the interested and affected parties, and also in the stakeholder summit where we made inputs on the valuable inputs from both the private sector, the NGOs, and the universities which attended the stakeholder summit. But now our minister had to consider the inputs from all these stakeholders and make the necessary amendments to the draft framework which was published. So what we're going to do now in the next few days is to gazette for implementation the Marine Special Planning Framework for South Africa, meaning that it's only now, after this has been gazetted, that we're going to start rolling into a process of marine area plans. I just wanted to note that the National Working Group is a group that is nominated by the respective DGs of the different departments. So there's just no way in which they could work independently from the mandate given to them by their DG. So what the DG of Environmental Affairs did request initially is for the departments to nominate members into these groups so that they represent the mandate of their respective sector and department. I'll end it there. Chair. I think the other colleagues could assist.
All right.
Thank you, Chair. I'll pick up on some of the issues. The first one was the jurisdictional issue. Yes, that's a very valid question. If you look at, we've cross-referenced in our definitions to the Maritime Zones Act, which gives you where the EEZ is, begins the territorial waters, etc. But why we've included all South African waters is because we have different rights and obligations up to the 200 nautical mile radius. So if we're planning, because, for example, other ships have rights of innocent passage in our EEZ, which is our exclusive economic zone, that's the 200 nautical mile radius. We've got rights over allocating resources within those areas. So each country then, and that comes from the UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is the seminal international instrument that allocated these areas to the different countries. So what happens is our 200 nautical mile area, similar to other countries, we have sovereignty over that in the sense that we've got the right to allocate resources, we've got the right to create navigation channels, we've got the right to do certain things. We also cannot do certain things. We cannot deny other countries access if they want right of innocent passage through the EEZ. So those things apply. But when we plan in that area, we plan only insofar as obviously what we're legally allowed to do within that area, and that's the context of the South African waters. And you'll see similarly in the ICM Act, which is the Integrated Coastal Management Act, deals with coastal management. We've also got reference to these areas. And it means that only insofar as the functions of that act are concerned and in that space, that's what we'd manage in that area. But we have to recognize it as part of our sovereign territory, so to speak, because it's been allocated to us internationally. And I want to also bring in the yes, you are right in that we have more rights in territorial waters, which would include which is your 12 nautical mile boundary, but it doesn't mean we don't have rights beyond. Just on the issue of the continental shelf, the extension, because I'm going to bring that in now because it links to that, we have made an application for the extension of the continental shelf. But that shelf extension claim is not, it doesn't involve the water. It involves the bottom, the sea bottom, the substrata, whatever they want to call it, because it's more for geological and mineral rights that you'd be able to have increase your sovereign territory to that area that extended. So if internationally our application for that extension is accepted, that means our territory will be extended to as far as our claim is concerned, as far as our claim laid claim to, if you want to call it. But that would also, we would be able to do planning there, but not insofar as marine resources are concerned, like fish, because it doesn't include the water column, but insofar as geological resources are concerned. So that would have to form part of our planning in some way or the other. I think Tubani answered the question about the plans being drawn up. The plans are not yet drawn. They are going to be drawn up. We've been doing all the groundwork before that. How we are currently operating? Actually in silos. So transport's been doing its own thing. Tourism's been doing its own thing. Environment's been doing its own thing. Mining's been doing its own thing. And we've discovered that we're clashing with each other. Because when somebody's publishing something that they want to do there and they're getting resistance from one of the other sectors, you're realizing, well, okay, the silo planning is not working so well anymore. That's why we're moving towards this, in short, if that makes sense. I'm going through this. The Section 8, is there a common understanding of consultation throughout the country? We have a specific piece of legislation called the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which prescribes minimum consultation processes. And that is actually, it says you either do this or you do more than this, or you can do something that's different that's equal to this. So that is our common understanding of consultation amongst governments. So that's the short answer is yes. The other question...
When you finish there, I want you to go back to that explanation about the 200 nautical miles and the 12 and vis-a-vis the application that... Just explain it slowly so that we can understand, but finish the other questions.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to the other question on the application. In fact, you know, this is drafted in a way that, and in fact, it's making me think that maybe it's not clear enough, because somebody else also asked that question. It's like you're making it look as if nobody else this act doesn't apply to everybody else, and that's not the intention. I'll tell you what was intended here, and if that intention is not captured, we may want to relook at the wording. When we're going through the process, the more detailed process, what was intended under application is that it applies to marine spatial planning on or in South African waters as a general. So planning on anything. In other words, anything that happens in South African waters, and that's where the question about the nautical miles and so forth came in, because if you look at South African waters, it's defined as such, Chairperson. Maybe this will also give some clarity to that question you asked. It's internal waters referred to in Section 3 of the Maritime Zones Act. Now, the Maritime Zones Act is the act that gave effect to what I mentioned earlier, UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, the key international agreement or treaty that allocated sea space to different countries. So that act, we don't repeat it, because if that act changes, then you have to change this act, so we just cross-reference. So we say when you look at internal waters are basically going to be your, like, your the bays and the not fresh waters. Some of it is like your estuaries that may be included. You know, in fact, Nikki has done a study on it, and if the committee permits, can I ask her to give a proper explanation when I'm done on the different zones, because she'll be able to explain them very, very articulately, with your permission, Chair. So I'll go on. I'm just going to read the stuff. The territorial waters and the EEZ and the continental shelf, as referred to in 4, 7, and 8 of the Maritime Zones Act. Again, they give you this explanation of the 200 nautical miles, etc., and what you can and can't do there. And then Prince Edward Islands are the islands that we also control, which is Marion and Prince Edward Islands, which are South African territory. So, of course, we control the terrestrial part of those islands, are part of South Africa's territory, as well as the EEZs and the territorial waters around those islands. So that exponentially increases the territorial span that South Africa has jurisdiction over. Now, when we talk about application, we're talking about it about planning. And we can do, if this applies, the planning that we can do in terms of this act and the framework can happen in all these areas. But the subtext of this is that obviously it can only happen in terms of what we're legally allowed to do or not. This act is not giving you carte blanche to do anything in an area that's either you're bound by international obligations not to, or that you have a law that says we can't do X, Y, Z. That's not what this is about. The planning is within existing legal frameworks that this can happen. And the reason we put "and binds organs of state" is to make it clear. Because very often if you don't put that clause in, government departments sometimes argue that they're not bound by this act because they're government. And, of course, this act has to be binding on organs of state because you can see the nature of it involves all the different government departments. And if one department decides, oh, well, okay, I don't think this applies to us, they can ignore everything that's happening in the planning process. And I take note that is not – it's not clearly set out here because it looks – the way it's written, you have to go to South African waters, you have to see what is marine spatial planning and then say, and it binds organs of state. So maybe we need to relook at the wording later on to make sure that we're covering the activities and everybody else that it applies to. So thank you for that. There was regarding conflicts, I'm also going to say this with the proviso that the DDG or any of the colleagues who feel that they can add can do so when I'm done. We're looking at the whole idea of resolution of conflicts, and you raised the issue of communities. You see, communities are more when you're dealing with the coastal management aspect, and when you're dealing with coastal management of resources and so forth, it's going to be particularly important. And granted, the smaller players have a role to play in what does equity mean when you're resolving that conflict, and that's where when we put the principles in. There has to be a common understanding that the information, and that's where that point about yours about the data, it does go without saying, but if we don't put it in here, it gives the impression that people can come with anything. But the more information that we get from the sectors, from the stakeholders, from the small-scale fishermen, from the small-scale ecotourism operators, the more information we get that feeds into the system, the easier it becomes to take their interests into account, which is why we're putting so much focus on the knowledge and the data and the documentation. Because remember, if information comes to the table and the small scale interests are not represented there, if they're not going to be taken into account. But if they are represented, then that clause on equity must apply to them. That's why it's put in there in such a broad way, and they can then be held accountable if they are dismissed as a sector. But remember, they're going to come with economic information, they're going to come with their social benefit information, because all of these are factors, and they have to be weighed against each other. And it's very difficult to say this is how the formula works, because there isn't a formula, but it's about balancing these interests. And if they come, the stronger the information is that we get, And that's why we want to be able to do regulations and say you must be able to submit this to us in order for this national working group to be able to make an informed decision. That equity certainly applies to that. And the conflicts and the relocations. Relocations is relocation of activities. And the bigger areas where this is going to be an issue, more than the coastal areas, because that has already been sorted in a manner of speaking. The key areas that have not been sorted are really the more offshore areas. And when I'm saying offshore, I'm talking about beyond the I don't know what the technical term is, and I can get help from some of the more technical people. The offshore seems to be the right term for it. The offshore activities where you've got liners and you've got mining interests where they want to drill deep. We're not talking about the nearshore stuff. We're talking about where they need heavy equipment, high capital intensive equipment to be in that area to begin with. In those areas, there's unlikely to be any small scale operators of any sort because it's highly capital intensive and it requires employment of large numbers of people, purchasing of heavy machinery and equipment, etc. And those are the big money spinners, if you want to call it. And it's important that there's a referee in that area. And that's where the conflict, because I can give you an example. You'll have deep sea fishing in an area. And there's a potential conflict with mining where an applicant wants to do some offshore drilling or exploration in an area where there's currently fishing happening and they have rights there. And they're both going to come there and say, listen, but an environment has a role to play in that because we have to see, we have to look at it from a sustainability perspective. So you're going to get three stories coming to this table, potentially more stories coming to this table. And in determining what is the best use for that, you're going to be armed by the information that you have, your scenarios, how much benefit this is going to be in the future, how sustainable it is, et cetera, et cetera. And the best that we can do in legislation is give you these broad principles that if you have not considered them and it looks like an obviously biased decision, it can be challengeable. So when we talk to equity, we're talking to it in that broad sense of trying to balance as many of these competing interests as possible in the best possible manner. And it is tested, and when you talk about communities, if there are communities involved in any of these and there's beneficiation, that's critical information that must inform that. So you've got, because sometimes social benefits will outweigh short-term large economic benefits. Sometimes sustainability will outweigh large economic benefits. Sometimes large economic benefits in a particular area will outweigh the others. So it's going to be that balancing because we can't say this is going to be how it's going to be play out every time because it depends on the circumstances, on the area, on sometimes climate conditions, etc. I wish I had a clearer way of saying I wish I had a code that says this is what we're going to do and this is how it's going to do it. But unfortunately, the reality of life is that we don't have such a code. And it's when you're dealing with situations, each circumstance is different. And because this is a transparent process and an openly consulted process, everyone will have access to that thinking at every given point in time of where the plans are, how they've been determined, what the criteria was. And these can be measured against what these principles are, and of course there's going to be unhappy players. Everybody knows that we get sued where there's a good decision or a bad decision because nobody's happy all the time about anything. So that's not going to be a test of whether it's working or not, but it's going to be what will be a test is have we put equitable and fair criteria in trying to determine these different balancing these different interests. I'll leave to my DDG to add to that. The instructions for consideration, sorry, that was the last thing that I've got here. That's a good pick up because that language we didn't even think of when we were drafting this thing. What was intended there is, yes, the National Working Group is a recommending body, but the DG's committee does have oversight over that group, which is why I can send it back. So what we meant to say, it can send back to them and say, you are instructed to reconsider or to look at these aspects which you haven't looked at before. And maybe this wording is not capturing that. So we'll have to think about that as well. But it's certainly, it's probably could be softened to say there must be that they can send recommendations to them to tell them to look for, but they can instruct because they've got to then give it further, the final decision-making body being the minister. So the only people who can reconsider are the National Working Group, actually, because they're the ones that did the work on the ground. So we will think about how to word that properly, but thank you. That was a very useful semantic observation. If I can hand over...
It does appear that in the department you have got and the entities, there are quite a number of colleagues who can really talk, who can really give lectures. We thought we had it all yesterday and today, and now, I must say you can really give a lecture about the subject. Can you come in? Let's just make it
short.
Very short.
Because there's little to add to what my colleagues have said.
Talk to the issue that we asked, the 12, the 200, and the application, and then you'll come and briefly explain. Define the waters, South African waters.
Okay, Chair, just to make the observation that the groups, in other words, the DG's group as well as the minister's group, are co-chaired by Environment and the Presidency, the PME, in order to make sure that the planning that occurs in the ocean space is aligned to the planning as would be pursued by DPME. Just to touch on what Advocate Razak said, Chair, you will recall that, as she said, that we've got the 12-mile zone, which is territory which belongs to South Africa exclusively. Then you've got 200 miles, which we call your economic exclusion zone.
Yeah, I missed the first one.
The first one is your territorial waters, it's 12 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And that area is owned by South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody from anywhere is allowed to enter that part of the ocean without permission from South Africa. It is South African property.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have...
The mic next to you.
Yeah. Then you've got the 200 miles. So from the high water mark or from the beach out 200 miles. That is called the economic exclusion zone, meaning that is the territory in which South Africa can exercise its economic interests. As Advocate Razak, other vessels or other nations are not precluded from driving or steaming or getting their ships through the 200-mile zone. But they may not take any resources there without South African permission. So 200-mile zone is your economic exclusion zone where economic activity belongs to you as South Africa. 12 miles is your territory.
With respect to the two islands, you still have the territorial waters and the economic zone.
Correct, Chair, you've got exactly the same.
Okay.
You've got the 12 miles and then you've got the 200 miles. What Advocate Razak was saying is we've now made an application to United Nations in order to extend the 200-mile zone to up to 375 miles, up to 350 miles out.
Mm.
But that area will not be treated exactly the same as your 200-mile exclusive economic zone, where you own both what is at the bottom or underneath the bottom, like minerals,
yeah.
Where you also own the fish and other animals in the water column. You own all that in the 200 mile zone. In the new area, if we get it, all we can benefit from is mining, what you call geology, geological interests. But what is on the water column, like fish, belongs to everyone, does not belong to South Africa. That's the difference between the two areas.
So it belongs to everybody?
Belongs to everybody. Freedom of the high seas.
Freedom of the high seas.
Yeah.
Oral Perry, are you fine? It looks like you're taking a nap.
No, I'm not taking a nap. I was going to give you an answer.
Okay.
Clarify. I was going to give you a clearer answer.
Give us a clearer answer then.
Okay. The EEZ is a sea zone prescribed by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, saying a state has a special right regarding the exploration and use of marine services, including energy production from water and wind. Okay, that's clear. That's the EEZ.
Okay.
And then the territorial waters comes from a 1982 United Nations Convention where it states that the territorial waters of countries will be 12 nautical miles, that's 22.2 kilometers, from the baseline, which is your low water mark.
But it's the same thing they say. Okay. You just preferred to read from the text and then he was explaining. But I think the two is the same thing. The only difference with this application is to probably want to do mining. You want to mine there. So I think that's the only difference. But can we move off that? Or should you organize a workshop? I see there are a lot of questions.
Not questions, sir. It's
okay.
Just a follow-up to what I raised earlier.
All right.
To me, if we say deeper in the ocean, you may not have smaller players. It's as if there will be other people will be excluded. So if you are up and coming, you can't venture because you have to be big in order to be there. So any other person must be excluded. It's definitely saying that. But the other is to say that when you say this is binding only to organs of state, it's as if these other people who are to be managed. No, but that's what it's saying. It gives that impression. Perhaps it will be reworked. I may no longer want to reemphasize that point. But the last point, Chair, is even as we say the DG's committee can refer back this kind of thing for reconsideration or consideration, if it comes as an instruction, it's like you don't have to do any other thing. You do as you just insert. So I thought because it says that they can refer back. So if you refer back, it's just for consideration, either proposals or whatever from themselves for, you know, reworking or something like that. But you can find a way of handling it than to say it's necessarily an instruction. But my point in the main, Chair, the follow-up, is who plays a role in the waters there. You can't put a, what is, not necessarily a ceiling. You can't say if you are you are up and coming. You can't compete with big ones who are already established and so on and so on. Yeah. But it's okay. You may not resolve it here and now. I think we're still going to process this.
Do you think we can have time between now and when we start the public hearing to accommodate a much more detailed workshopping of the bill? Not only the bill, but even the framework, because the framework does have an impact on this, so that we are all on the same path. Do you think you can make the time available so that we don't have to spend more time now on this. We can either allocate 2 hours or so before we start with the public hearings for a much more detailed workshopping of this, and then we go, including the other issues that involve the sea, which are going to keep on cropping up as we discuss this issue.
Chair, we most of us were based in Cape Town, so
okay,
we will come.
You don't have to travel up and down.
Yes,
we can even do it after the sitting. Or all right, I think it's fine. Maybe some of these questions, let's just note them for that discussion. Unless if they are urgent. Okay. Let's note them for that discussion then. And then now let's get an explanation on the definition of South African water. Is that it? No. You said the lady will do it. No, she can just go. She can just talk to us. Talk to us, madam, and introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair and honorable members. My name is Nikki Lecoq. I work with my colleague, Radia, in the law reform section. My DDG has already elaborated on that, but just to summarize in very brief terms, the South African waters, as he correctly explained, is the 12 nautical miles from the baseline, which is the low water mark. Behind that baseline, which will be harbors and estuaries, are your internal waters. And then the 200 nautical miles, which is your exclusive economic zone, that area is where we are allowed to exploit resources like fish and non-living resources like minerals, oil, and gas. And then, of course, with the extended shelf claim beyond that, we're allowed to exploit minerals again, oil and gas, but not the living resources, which is the fish. So it was already covered. I don't need to explain anything further.
Oh, I thought you'd come up with the categories for waters. That this is territorial waters. This is what this beyond the expert, but it's fine. I think we get a sense. Because others will think that when you talk about South African waters, you are even referring to the dams, you know. I stay in an area next to the dam, so I thought when you put your definition and refer to the waters, the Hardis Dam is also included. But anyway, let's just end it on the note that I think before we start full steam, we'll then do that two and a half hour workshop, and then you'll then prepare sort of an explanatory memorandum to the bill that will also help in the workshopping process, and then we'll then be ready to do the public hearing of the bill. Is it fine? Okay. Thank you very much for that. The next engagement. The next engagement will be. Oh, Judy, gonna be on. From yourself and your team on the the feedback or report of the Marrakesh conference. We should be having our own report. Where is our report, Doc? Speak to that. There's something there next to you. No, speak to the mic.
Honorable Chair Hussein, Chileka sent a copy to all the members
okay.
In the last communication.
Yesterday?
Yes.
Did you have it yesterday?
Yes.
sir. Because I was thinking that as we consider this briefing, we should also look at our own report and then just adopt it at once so that we don't have to come back again for it. Yeah, Judy?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. We have a short presentation. I'm here with my colleague, Mr. Kutazi Steleki. He is the Director for International Climate Change Negotiations. The Chief Director, Mr. Maisela Kikana, is already on his way to the preparatory meeting for COP23, which takes place in Bonn now, starting early next week, with the pre-meetings already starting this week. So he is already in Bonn, and Mr. Steleki will be following him shortly. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, the background really, I think, is well known to Honourable Members. Marrakesh COP22 of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change took place in Morocco in December last year. It was an important transitional moment after years of negotiating the Paris Agreement to the start of implementation. And it was therefore called the COP of Action, or the Implementation COP. And the main task of COP22 was to agree to a work program that would be guide all parties for the implementation of the Paris Agreement rulebook. It's called the Paris Agreement rulebook because that is the multilateral set of rules that will enable the implementation of the Paris Agreement. Paris Agreement is only implemented from 2020. It's a post-2020 climate regime. And so therefore Morocco also dealt with enhancement of pre-2020 action, and there was a high-level ministerial dialogue, in fact a number of meetings around the pre-2020 action. Next slide. South Africa's priorities going into COP22 were fairly succinct and clear. We wanted to ensure inclusiveness in the multilateral decision-making process, and that really refers to the fact that there was unexpected progress in the ratification and entry into force of the Paris Agreement, with the necessary numbers of parties ratifying so that the Paris Agreement could enter into force during the Marrakesh meeting. The key question then was how to ensure inclusiveness of decision-making in the remaining work that needed to be done, noting on the multilateral rulemaking process, and to ensure that that process enabled the greatest number of parties to continue participating. We also wanted to ensure that there were further discussions on the modalities, procedures, and guidelines of the Paris Agreement, and we wanted to promote South Africa's contribution to climate change. These three objectives were largely achieved. Next slide. I think just to go very, very briefly over what was achieved in terms of the post-2020 work stream. Here, the proposal from the COP-MOP CMA-1 is the first COP-MOP of the Paris Agreement. So that was the first meeting of the parties to the Paris Agreement that took place in Morocco. We welcomed the proposal for the CMA-1 for the COP to continue overseeing the implementation of the work program under the Paris Agreement. So essentially this means that the Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention continues that process of overseeing the implementation of the Paris Agreement. The work program will be the outcomes of the work program will be forwarded to the resumed first meeting of the meeting of the parties in 2018. So that essentially means that there is a total of 2 years really available from December 2016 to December 2018 for the finalization of the multilateral rulemaking process to give effect to the Paris Agreement, and that the meeting of the parties will then take place, it will be resumed in 2018. What was also important was that the Conference of Parties mandated the Ad Hoc Working Group on Paris Agreement, that's the APA, that's the acronym there, to finalize the issue of the Adaptation Fund to serve the Paris Agreement. Now here, the issue was that the Adaptation Fund was previously a fund of the Kyoto Protocol, and there were really some administrative procedures that needed to take place to allow the Adaptation Fund to serve the Paris Agreement by 2018. So there are governance and institutional issues, safeguards and operating modalities that have to be finalized, that have to be negotiated to enable that to take place. There were a number of so-called homeless, there's a typo there, not holes or orphan items, but homeless items, orphan items, that were not, we did not manage in the final negotiations leading to the Paris Agreement to give direction on all issues in the Paris Agreement as to which institutional arrangement those items would be allocated. As members know, there are many structures under the UNFCCC, and each of those structures have different responsibilities. So there's a subsidiary body on implementation, there's a subsidiary body on technology, there's the Ad Hoc Working Group on the Paris Agreement, etc. And each of the key issues requiring further negotiation had to be allocated to one of those structures. Some of those were left out, and we had to have a process for ensuring that those homeless or orphan items were allocated, and that was finalized. We also invited COP22 president, together with the incoming COP23 president, to undertake informal consultation sessions on the 2018 facilitative dialogue on enhancing ambition and support. Now, this is an important dialogue taking place at COP 2018, so that will be COP 24, and it's important that parties are all on the same page as to what exactly we want to achieve at that dialogue. It's important because it also talks to the pre-2020 era. And it particularly focuses on ambition, and that's in particular focusing on ambition related to developed countries and support provided by developed countries to developing countries. And then finally, what was critical was the outcome urged parties of the Kyoto Protocol to ratify the Doha Amendment to the Kyoto Protocol. This was an important issue because the Paris Agreement has come into force so fast, but the Kyoto Protocol, the Doha Amendment to the Kyoto Protocol, is still outstanding. Next slide. There was good progress in furthering discussions on the modalities, procedures, and guidelines of the Paris Agreement. In particular, the rule book, as I've said, the work program was agreed, the time frame was agreed, the mode of work was agreed, and the allocation of the those homeless or additional items. Key amongst those was the common time frames for nationally determined contributions. This refers specifically to synchronizing the time frame for the submission on a 5-year or on a 10-year basis of by countries of their nationally determined contributions going into the future. There were other so-called unallocated items, namely education, training, and public awareness. Next slide. On the pre-2020 items, the Paris Committee on Capacity Building, the terms of reference were adopted, the committee members were elected, and the 2-year work plan was agreed to. This was an important area of progress. It basically establishes a multilateral institutional arrangement to support countries, provide capacity building support to countries. Also, the capacity building for enhanced transparency there was good progress here. The CBIT refers to the capacity building for enhanced transparency fund under the Global Environment Facility was agreed. There were $50 million worth of pledges to the new fund. South Africa was amongst the first to receive funding. We received $1 million, and this is to ensure that or to support our greenhouse gas reporting processes, also our reporting processes on adaptation. There was a high-level ministerial dialogue on climate finance, and there were additional pledges of $81 million to the Adaptation Fund, which was a really important outcome for Africa. There was also extensive discussion on the roadmap to mobilize the $100 billion per year by 2020. The key issue here is the methodology to calculate the extent to which those funds have or have not been mobilized. And that has not yet been agreed, and that is still under discussion. Next slide. Really, finally, on the pre-2020 work stream, the high-level ministerial on enhancing action, Africa launched the Africa Adaptation Initiative, and there was a progress report presented on the Africa Renewable Energy Initiative. These are both quite important continental initiatives, firstly to support African adaptation planning processes, and secondly to support renewable energy programs on the continent. We made inputs on strengthening the what is known as the technical examination process for mitigation and adaptation, which will be taking place now in May in 2017. These technical examination processes basically are an opportunity for parties or different countries to present their best practice, both from a perspective of reducing emissions and from the perspective of adapting to the impact of climate change. I think also just to say that Minister Molewa signed a bilateral cooperation with the German Minister of Environment. Once again, the GIZ will be the main delivery unit to support the climate change activities that are funded by the German Ministry of Environment. And the ministers agreed that there needs to be effective support to developing countries provided in a coordinated fashion. I must say that the German Ministry of Environment has continued their efforts to support South Africa in our implementation. I think finally, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, just to say that we are now engaged in the next steps, which is starting to look ahead into COP23, which is taking place in Bonn this year at the end of November. It will be chaired by Fiji, and that Fiji has indicated that their focus is on delivering support to those nations that are at risk, particularly at risk, and they're focusing on low-lying and vulnerable countries. And they also want to focus on crafting the Paris Agreement rule book. There has been a basic meeting. That's the Brazil, India, China, and South Africa meeting. It took place on the 11th of April, and our deputy minister attended it. And the purpose of that meeting was for the basic countries to really strategize around the preparation for COP23. And to look at the nature of how we can support, how we can collectively support Fiji to ensure that COP23 is an effective conference of the parties. One of our biggest priorities for COP23 is once again the pre-2020 agenda, not only the post-2020 agenda of the rulebook, but also the pre-2020 agenda and ensuring that the Doha Amendment to the Kyoto Protocol comes into force. I think there may certainly be questions around the USA. The USA has really so far not pronounced itself very clearly. There have been various statements, but our understanding is that there are still differing views within the U.S. At this stage, the best that we can do, and working within the African continent and working with Brazil, India, and China, is really reiterate our firm commitment to the multilateral process. And in the basic statement, honourable members will see that. There's a signal of momentum in the multilateral process that would be very difficult to roll back, and I think that is a message to the U.S. government. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members.
Thank you very much. That's the presentation. You want to add? Okay. All right. The DDG has covered everything. Questions? No questions. Okay. In terms of the nationally determined contributions, we have a draft now. The Paris Agreement requires that we must have a final document by when, not the draft. and in doing so, maybe we must just talk to the other item that we also wanted to be briefed on. Are we going to have a separate brief on the legislative framework?
Honourable Chair, I can do. There are a few slides, and I can take you through the few slides. I could respond, and then we could move on. Whatever you would prefer.
Maybe do that, the legislative framework, and then let's discuss all of them.
All of it together.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. All right, so honourable members, the purpose of the work that has been initiated on a climate change response legal framework is to give effect to certain elements of the National Climate Change Response Policy, and to establish the basis for achieving South Africa's international climate change commitments. The National Climate Change Response Policy has a number of elements in it that do not require a legal framework, That said, it also has certain elements in which a legal framework would not only be very supportive, but in some cases would certainly be necessary. So at this stage, it's at a very early process. The process thus far is that there have been engagements internally in the department to agree on a broad approach to the regulatory framework. We have drafted a discussion document presenting the expected objectives and the expected outcomes of such a legal instrument to discuss with the MINTEC working groups. The MINTEC working groups are the forums in which we engage with the provinces. Climate change is very much one of those functions that is a concurrent competency, and it therefore requires collective and coordinated implementation by national, provincial, and local government, and then, of course, with stakeholders as well. So the first draft setting out content of a climate change response legal framework on the basis of the draft discussion document is currently being discussed within the department with sector departments and with provinces. And at the time that this presentation was prepared, we had a workshop scheduled for the 1st of March. At that, workshop took place, and at that workshop we received quite extensive comments. In fact, we really received very good and extensive comments, which we're now reworking and are putting together a revised draft, which will go through the process of the MINTEC working groups once again. Ultimately, it has to go through the various structures of government. It has to go to the economic cluster, which is a cluster of sector departments. It has to go through MINTEC, has to go through MINMEC, and it gets presented to Cabinet for approval to publish for public comment. Let's just see if there's another slide. The objectives... really, this is a very early stage, but the objectives would be to provide for the coordinated and integrated management of the impacts of climate change by all spheres of government in accordance with the principles of cooperative governance, effectively manage inevitable climate change impacts through interventions that build and sustain South Africa's social, economic, and environmental resilience and emergency response capacity, and then thirdly, to make a fair contribution to the global effort to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So the timeframes: by the end of March, stakeholder consultation on the discussion document, and then climate change response legal frame gazetted for public comment. We were way too ambitious for achieving that last point, way too ambitious. And we basically have, from the discussion with MINTEC in March, we have gone back into a cycle of tightening the objectives, tightening the discussion on the form of such legal frameworks. It could either be in the form of a standalone bill, or it could be in the form of a NEMA amendment. And that discussion is still taking place with sector departments and MINTEC. And so, honourable members, as you can hear, we really are at a very early stage in this. Is there another? Yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Very, very early stage. You know, when you talk about you being ambitious, the buzzword in climate change efforts is ambition. So there's nothing wrong in being ambitious. You must have that ambition to get to the 2% that
2 degrees Celsius that we're talking about in Marrakesh. But, you know, I'm worried about the process. And I pick up that there seem to be a lack of appetite for this legislative framework. Because we would want to have a situation where we've got legislation. It's quite clear that industry is not going to come to the party on this thing of climate change. We saw it for ourselves during the oversight visit on air quality, that most of these companies that are responsible for these greenhouse gas emissions are not going to invest in their operation or in their activities to such an extent that they will reduce the carbon footprint. They continue as business as usual. So without legislation, there's nothing that you're going to do. Without even the strategy, there are many people who have written to critique even the nationally determined contributions that we have come up with as a country. And part of the criticism is that up to so far, we still believe that industry can come on board, and they are not. So that's why we believe that we need to have that framework presented so that we can gradually move towards having a law. You know, in the continent, South Africa, I think, is the biggest emitter, largely because of the complexities of how complex is our industrial base and our economy. And therefore, in as much as we are saying other big countries like China, like the US, and some other European countries must put more efforts in reducing emissions, we must also lead by example in the African continent, because we are the biggest emitters. So if we are doing what we are doing now without wanting to do something that fundamentally alters how things are happening now, we are not going to register any progress. See, that's my view. And that's the view of the committee, that we need legislation to begin to be seen that we are serious about climate change initiatives in this country. And the fact that there is very little progress even in the legislative framework, legal framework, is not going to impose any obligation on anybody, because the only way to do that is through the parliamentary process of having a law that will be able to push everybody else. All those people who have got concerns about the law, they must come to Parliament and present their views here. There must be other counter views. We will be very clear of what we want to do as Parliament. So I don't know what is the view of the colleagues, but I from where I'm seated, I think I will insist that that process must come. We should not find ourselves in a situation where we then, on our own as Parliament, it has happened in other countries. It happened in Kenya. Kenya is one of the African countries that has got climate change legislation. It was not initiated at the level of the executive, as you know, Judy. It was initiated by members of Parliament because of those competing interests that are there that are still being managed somewhere. So we may not have the capacity now to do that, but I think we must work with the department to get that process initiated so that we can run it through. By the time you develop your nationally determined contribution, you will be having a legal base from where to do it. Industries will be knowing that these are the timelines, these are the legal instruments that will force us to comply with those timelines, and then we'll start doing that. Any comment? Agreed? Yeah. The committee agrees that we want the legislation. You must bring it to us, or we will take that process forward ourselves, because we are lawmakers. You know, that's one of our responsibilities.
Honourable Chair, if I can just give you comfort that we are working as fast and as hard as we possibly can. The process has to conclude. We have to get buy-in from the sector departments and from provinces and from stakeholders before we will bring this to you. Of course, it comes to you straight after it has been tabled in cabinet for gazetting for public comment. We receive the public comment and we then do the adjustment. We then go back to cabinet. And we get approval for tabling in Parliament. So we are working absolutely as fast as we can to get the bill to you. And I think just to also give members comfort that at the same time and in parallel with that work, the NDC has been finalised. So the nationally determined contribution that is on the UNFCCC website is our nationally determined contribution, and that is our commitment for 2025 and 2030. There are a series of commitments, as you would know, Honourable Chair, for adaptation and emission reduction. Our emission reduction commitment is it gives us a range between 398 and 614 megatons reduction between 2025 and 30, and then we have a series of adaptation commitments. So that is in place, and what is also in place, or very close to in place, is phase one of our emission reduction system, where we are getting industries to commit to carbon budgets, as well as our national adaptation strategy. So the legal framework.
What is the commitment of industry to carbon budget?
We have
are they investing
18,
in that?
We have 18 companies so far that have committed to a carbon budget. Phase one is at this stage based on current operations so that we get the system functional, and phase two will be on the basis of the legal framework. So we have to have the legal framework in place. So I really want to give comfort that we are moving as fast as we can to get the legal framework in place and into Parliament.
Okay. Was there a question? By the way, you answered that question about the nationally determined contributions. Anything... I see my colleagues are exhausted now.
Not we are awaiting the process. We want that process to be really underway so that we engage with it extensively.
Okay. So, Doc, what is the process now of taking this thing to Parliament, to the House? Honourable Chair,
she is actually the procedural officer for carrying it forward beyond the committee.
Okay. But you can speak if you also have some...
No, we need to adopt it in the committee with the recommendation that it be adopted by the House.
Adopt what? The department or ours?
Ours.
Okay. We must all speak, yeah?
The committee.
All right. Thank you, Chair. I just need to advise that in terms of the quorum, we're not correcting today. Honorable Pardon was not part of the delegation, so that means we have three members. So we can look at it, maybe adopt it next week, Tuesday, when we have the full component of the committee.
The quorum is how many of those who attended?
50 plus. So we need...
No, we were five. We were five. It was myself, Honorable Makubele, and Honorable Edwards.
Hadebe.
It was...
And Nyambi.
Yeah, we're only five. So three of five is more than 50%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can adopt. So as we are, it's a quorum. 2, 4. Okay, let's postpone it for next week then. Next week, we'll deal with that next week. Thanks, Judy. Just know that we have got the greatest of interest in that process of a legal framework. We want it here.
And Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, we very much appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. You didn't say anything, my brother.
It will give more impetus, you know, to the process of legislation or legislative framework. So we really appreciate that. It will give more weight. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. The only thing outstanding, Honourable Members, is the program, the committee program. You know, as you know, the program is always a living document. It will keep on amending wherever necessary. But are we fine with the program? It was late yesterday and today, no? Okay. But are we fine with it? Do we adopt the program? Going. Honorable Makurian.
Chair, just to say that both yesterday and today, there are issues that we said would need to be factored in our program going forward, either presentations by departments or the entities which may need to come back. Perhaps that prioritization of those issues may need to be done. But as you say, I think I'm covered in the sense that it's a living document. So as and when they get factored, depending on how we prioritize them, the document can still serve in the committee. But for now, we're going to operate on the basis of this one. Lastly, the adoption of the document on Marrakesh or the climate change one. Remember, there was a country delegation and a parliamentary delegation. So we need broadly, I know we had these other discussions, but this portfolio committee should be leading in that regard. But we are adopting a broader one, which must be inclusive of even what part of our negotiators were doing, because we could not be everywhere. So that process, as it goes through parliament, it will be inclusive of everything. It cannot be just partly what parliamentarians interacted with, and then there be another part separately. It will be the entire thing and will be debated in parliament holistically, I should say.
Okay, maybe the fact that we don't have a quorum is a blessing in disguise, so that we can allow... The team doc to factor in this report that comes from the department in the report, so that it becomes the country report instead of just being only parliament. Because we now were briefed on some of the processes, the discussion. If you need anything else, you can just follow up with Judy so that we incorporate as suggested by Honorable Makobel. And then as soon as we are ready, we table it, we adopt, and then we send it to the House for and we request that there must be a debate on the report when it's approved. Okay, thank you very much, honorable members, for your endurance and participation. It was really a two-day grueling session. Thank you very much to the department. This is Judy and the other team. Judy has been here from yesterday. I can see it has also taken a toll on you. You look very tired. But yeah, thank you very much. We are done now. We have dealt with all the APPs of the entities and the department. So we are ready then to debate the budget vote when the minister comes and present. So we'll be ready to have that debate from the information that we shared here. There are other outstanding issues which I think, as Honorable Makubela says, we'll prioritize them. We know the Secretary has been noting them, and there are other decisions as well that we've taken, particularly in relation to SOS, that we will then formally communicate to them through a letter that we must draft and send to them before the end of the week, just to communicate to them what we have resolved as a committee. But otherwise, thank you very much. I think we'll see each other next week. Is there something next week? What's happening next week? So we'll deal with the budget vote report. Is it next week? Yeah, no, that one, take it out. All right, next week then we'll have a draft committee report on the budget vote. They're going to draft now, so it's still going to be in the first draft probably. And then we've dealt with a briefing on the Waste Bureau. We're going to receive a report from DIA on the decision to authorize the mining in the Mabula protected area in Mpumalanga. And then we're going to issue a letter now to Northwest if they agree to allow the scientists to come. We'll then have that briefing with them. If they don't, we advise that we must just send them a second letter. If they don't, then they will then have to issue summonses after that. So the intention is to have them next week, and the marine, what we are going to take it out, the marine special planning bill, until we have that workshop, and then after that we will we will then schedule the public hearing on the bill. Honorable Edward?
On the program, it says we've got committee next week until 4. Isn't it plenary?
No, there will be plenary next week. I think the thing has been changed. The program was changed during recess.
Uh-huh.
And by the time we drafted this one was before recess.
Okay, now I'm just making you...
Yeah. So I think we're only going to have two. It's going to be the Northwest and the briefing by the department and possibly just the draft report. The draft report we're not going to even discuss. So essentially we have got only two issues there. We will assess if they are not responsive, we may have to schedule something else. But for now, that's that. Okay, thank you very much for coming. The meeting is adjourned.
Okay.